This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey folks, we've got an update on this show, an update on some of the people from the rise and fall of Harry Knowles and Ain't It Cool News, as well as an interview with graphic novel documentarian Brian Box Brown about his new book, The He-Man Effect. All of this and more, so let's get ready to dial up, log on, and download.
Welcome.
Welcome to Download. I'm Joe Scott. I'm here in my house getting ready to go on my annual trip to the Carolina coast, which is great for two reasons. One, it's always good to go there. Just sitting out there on the beach, reading, relaxing, it really just detoxes my brain. I think it's the sound of the ocean. It sort of just is a natural way to just defrag a lot of the cluttered, chaotic thoughts that I might have accumulated over the years. But I think the other reason is this. When I was working on The Rise and Fall of Harry Knowles and Ain't It Cool News, I finished the very last episode, The Air We Breathe, there on that annual vacation last year. So I thought it would be great to take a quick moment before I get in the car and drive 4 hours to just talk with you guys a little bit about the show and how things are going. Yeah, it's been a year since we've made a new episode, and I'm sure some people are wondering, when are we going to begin work on new episodes or stories? And the answer to that is this. I have been working on new episodes, there's a little twist. We hit two roadblocks. One story we pursued, which was very internet-focused, it just got too dangerous. You know, working on the Harry Knowles story, I think we definitely stirred up kind of a micro troll army. And I realized very quickly as I was working on this this internet-focused story, which was really compelling to me. I was actually honestly very obsessed with it. But I just realized it was too dangerous. The trolls tied to this story are far more malicious, are far more dangerous. As things got even slightly difficult, in the reporting and the research, I just realized I need to get away from this, just for the safety and health and overall well-being of, my family. So I backed away from that story entirely. I then pursued another story, and you know, the way I do stories, I get an idea of who I want to talk to. And then I do a lot of research because I don't want to just reach out to someone having done no research. And so I poured months of research into this other story idea I had. It was more, it was slightly internet focused, but more movie focused. And after a few months of research, I reached out to this person. They seemed to appreciate the time I took to research their work, but they didn't want to do an interview. They didn't want to talk about what happened with the story. I think they carry some personal scars, some personal issues related to that. And they just are trying to keep it all behind them, which I understand entirely. That's their choice and I respect their decision. It never feels great to leave a lot of research just there behind, but that's what I did again. That happened twice. But I have some good news. I finally have a new show. It was sort of an idea that was given to me by a media partner, someone who's going to be working with us at least tangentially on this project. And I've got several interviews already underway. And this project will be more episodic as opposed to like a giant long form story. And what's really good is the main person I wanted to talk to for my very first episode, who was incredibly difficult to find and to contact, I found them, and we've had three conversations so far, and we're beginning to find a story that I think tackles a lot of ideas and themes that inspire me. And I hope maybe the same will be for you, but it's going to take me a little while to get around this piece and around other pieces that'll be part of sort of the first season of this new project. But when I have something ready to share, you'll be able to find that here on this feed. One quick plug. I was very fortunate to do an interview with Barbara Genova. She wrote a piece about this podcast and about my work. And she was just asked a lot of really thoughtful questions. I've known Barbara for a minute now. She sort of approached me first as a listener of the show. We just began a correspondence. And yeah, it was really nice to have someone who had done a lot of thoughtful sort of introspection about my work and gave me a chance to kind of reflect on what we had done almost an entire year ago. So that was really cool. And I'm going to add a link to that interview in our show notes. It's not a podcast. You actually have to read it, but I think it turned out really great. Before we jump into this interview I did with Brian Box Brown about his new book, The He-Man Effect, which comes out on July 11th, I wanted to share a few updates about some of the people we covered in our first story, The Rise and Fall of Harry Knowles and Ain't It Cool News. But to do that, I want to start by playing a clip from our final episode, The Air We Breathe. So without further ado, previously on the last episode of the Download Podcast. Also, we just found out as we were recording these credits that Elon Musk is currently trying to back out of his bid to purchase Twitter. Fantastic. In the meantime, definitely find ways to lift up, support, and defend the voices of people who aren't like you. And, you know, listen to that. I sound so chipper, so assured. But what the fuck did I know, right? You know, essentially, Twitter sued Elon Musk and said, hey, you offered to buy our website for a ridiculous amount of money. You can't pull back your offer now. And being sort of forced by this lawsuit, he ponied up the cash and took over Twitter. You know, and I kind of hit on the fact that if Elon took over Twitter and got rid of its moderation protocols, which he did, that Twitter would essentially become exactly like the talkbacks of Ain't It Cool News, which were a haven for toxic hate speech directed at women, people of color, and queer folks. All of those things have happened. And what's crazy is he's actually letting these toxic chuds pay $8 a month to amplify their horrible voices. But what I didn't realize is that it would actually be worse than Ain't It Cool News. You know, saying that it was going to become talkbacks was almost an insult to talkbacks based on how Twitter turned out. You know, one time I was just on Twitter and I was just scrolling through my feed and I caught a video and there was just a kit. And I was like, oh, a cute kitten. Then a hand enters the frame and picks the kitten up and throws it in a blender and caps the lid on. And I had to suddenly scroll because I saw a finger was getting ready to press the button and blend this kitten into bits. And it was awful. It was terrible. Nothing like that has ever happened on the talkbacks of Ain't It Cool News. And I think all of the advertisers who are pulling out of Twitter and no longer advertising on that platform are absolutely right to do so. You know, and as of this week, we now have these two major Twitter clones, Blue Sky, which was created by Twitter founder Jack Dorsey. And that's where I'm at. I'll share a link to that in the show notes. And then there's another one called Threads, which was created by Mark Zuckerberg as an offshoot of Instagram. And, you know, I have a lot of friends who are suddenly on Threads as well, but I'm personally going to pause before I open another social media account with Mark Zuckerberg. He's got enough of my data right now. Some other updates. Let's talk about some of the actual people who were in The Rise and Fall of Harry Knowles and Ain't It Cool News. The first one I want to discuss is someone who is secretly the main character of the story, Drew McWeeny, who is one of my favorite writers at Ain't It Cool News. It appears that Netflix may or may not be making another season of War. At least they've not announced one yet. In the meantime, Drew is continuing to work on both his Substack as well as a brand new podcast he's calling The Hip Pocket, which I hope launches very soon. And I will put links for each of those projects in the show notes so you can keep up with what Drew is doing on your own. But then there was something major that happened late last year. And I don't know too many details, but Drew announced that basically he's now working on a show. Or a it might not be a show. It might actually be a movie. But I think it's a show. He's been very mum on the details. But he's been working on it until he was ultimately forced to stop due to the writer's strike. But, you know, I'm really curious to see what he does, what he makes. I wish him all the best. Another major character, C. Robert Cargill. His movie, The Black Phone, made a lot of money. It was the first movie to sort of ignite a non-sequel horror craze in the post-pandemic box office. And he's not only working as a writer, but is now a producer on a new film called The Gorge, which stars Anya Taylor-Joy and Miles Teller and Sigourney Weaver. Really looking forward to that. Eric Vespi is still running strong with the King Cast, his Stephen King podcast. That's always good. Steve Prokopy, aka Capone, is doing exciting work with the Music Box Theater in Chicago. Every time he promotes a screening, whether it's like a 70 millimeter presentation of 2001 or a collection of Wes Anderson films in 35 millimeter, I just immediately feel terrible that I don't live in Chicago, because I would love to attend all of those screenings. But if I had to pick, of all the people who worked with Ain't It Cool News, if I had to pick sort of a post Ain't It Cool News career, I think Steve's sounds the best by far. I would love to work in a theater like the Music Box, but that's really awesome. Another person we talked to, Jeremy Smith, aka Mr. Beaks. He seems to be doing all right. I hope he will eventually release his memoir / history of internet film journalism soon. And then the last person we'll talk about is Alan Cerny, you know, the person I sort of befriended while working on this project. As we spoke about in that last episode, he was retiring from his job. Well, ultimately he did that and then decided to unretire. I think it's kind of hard to fill the days if you're so used to having a day job and then you take that away. Like, what do you do with all that time? I think he struggled to find that answer, and so he just went back to work. He's still working in film criticism. He's still hosting a podcast, and I'm really excited to see what he does next. For the website, Ain't It Cool News, perhaps goaded by this project, a writer named Eric McClanahan, who wrote for Ain't It Cool under the name McEric, began pumping out a lot of work for Ain't It Cool News. You know, there was a period where they were lucky to have maybe more than one or two articles a month. Suddenly, he was just packing it with his byline and a lot of articles, a lot of content. And then suddenly, that has slowed down again. But the site is still live.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Now it's time to set you up for our guest, a person who was honestly a big inspiration behind the work that we did on this podcast. He's a graphic novelist, documentarian, or documentary graphic novelist, Brian Box Brown. And, you know, one day I read his book, Tetris, The Games People Play, which is about the dirty deals and behind the scenes, just douchebaggery that happened behind the video game Tetris, which is one of the greatest video games of all time. And Brian not only did a great job of sort of capturing this moment, this crucial moment in the history of nerd culture, but also sort of tying it to capitalism and the way it affected, in particular, the Russian developers who built this video game. You know, he really showed me that there's a lot of things that have happened sort of in these nerd spaces that are interesting and that have great stories. And Brian has a new book And one of the reasons I'm actually talking to him right now is because Brian has a new book coming out July 11th called The He-Man Effect: How American Toy Makers Sold Your Childhood. And in our show, one of the things that we chronicled is how, after many professional film critics lost their jobs, there was this pivot in cinema culture where most big budget films produced by studios were based on brands and well-known IP. And this led to an explosion of comic book movies, which has recently hit its exhaustion point with the flop of the Warner Brothers film, The Flash. But even then, these same studios are expanding to make films based on other properties, well-known properties, like video games with the Super Mario Brothers, which is the highest grossing film of this year, despite many poor reviews, as well as Barbie, based on the popular doll by Mattel, a film which many believe could have the most hype of any film being released this year. And Mattel actually announced an entire slate of film projects based on their toys, including Barney, which they are saying is going to be this A24-style project starring Oscar-winning actor Daniel Kaluuya, whatever that means, as well as Hot Wheels, which its attached director, J.J. Abrams, promises will be an emotional, grounded, and gritty film. I never thought that when I played with those toys as a kid. And then, yes, even He-Man. And the question is, why are these brands still so popular? And Brian's book actually sets out to show us the reasons, which are all tied to federal regulations that were intended to actually protect children from the deeply persuasive power of TV advertisements, which impacted their minds far greater than adults, and how corporations pushed to have these regulations lifted during the Reagan administration. And when that happened, the result were children's TV series like He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers, Glow Friends, Popples, My Little Pony, etc., all of which were basically toy advertisements disguised as TV shows. And what Brian argues in his book, and what makes me deeply afraid, not only as a parent, but as someone who grew up during this time, is that these shows hijack a space in a child's developing mind that is typically reserved for imagination, and replaces it with marketing propaganda disguised as lore, which children remember and recite almost like passages from the Bible. And what's worse is that they carry this knowledge with them for the rest of their lives, whether it's the stories, the theme songs, the character names. They carry this the rest of their lives as nostalgia. It just begs the question, what is the future or even the hope of the human imagination? And this is one of the things I tried to find out during my talk with Brian. We also talk about what it was like for him as a nonfiction storyteller to see the Apple Plus film Tetris crib so much of his work and story beats from his graphic novel without giving him so much as a thank you mention in the credits, among many other things. And without further ado, here is Brian Box Brown. And I say, so as an adult who's well into his middle age, there's few joys in my life than going into my local comic book store, which if you're ever in Greensboro, North Carolina, hit up Selfish Comics, Greensboro. But going into my local comic book shop and finding out there's a brand new graphic novel by our guest today, Brian Box Brown, I immediately buy them. I immediately read them, and you know, there's part of me that tries to rationalize, let's partial out the joy here because you got to make this last. It takes a long time to make original graphic novels, but yeah. Invariably, I just binge the whole thing in one day. And he's got a brand new graphic novel coming out July 11th. That's The He-Man Effect. Brian Box Brown, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so let's talk about this new book you've got coming out. It's sort of... First off, what I really like about your work is that you really do embrace the genre of documentary within the medium of comic books. And very few people do that. I think even fewer people do it well. And you find a way to keep it punchy, interesting. And I think part of it is that you really find story concepts and angles that few people considered. And with this book, what you're essentially doing is you're telling the story about how, due to deregulation in children's TV program during the 80s and during the Reagan era, you had toy manufacturers who brazenly just made TV shows to sell toys to children, i.e. people like me. And I'm guessing, based on how you look, you probably are growing up around the same time in the 80s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what inspired this idea to tell this story?
It was because I was like going through this period of revisiting all this stuff that I loved as a kid and trying to understand this feeling that I was having, you know, this feeling of nostalgia that's like was so intense. I remember I would do it like while I was working, I would always watch TV. I still do that all the time. And I would spend some time like, I think I was like listening to Howard Stern show all morning, and like it would take till the afternoon to listen to the whole thing. So then by like the afternoon, I'd be like, I need something else. And I would find all this old stuff that I used to like. And this was like a while ago now, and you know, probably like 10 years ago. And, you know, I'm revisiting all this stuff, and I'm like, wow, man, I like really, I'm getting these like intense feelings from like looking at the stuff. I'm like buying the old toys, you know, and looking at all this old stuff. And it's occurring to me, I think, I don't know if I went to a toy show or something like that. I don't know if I had started the book at that point, but it really like was solidifying going to that show, because I was like, look at all this commerce that's happening now. This is like a huge packed toy show in Oaks, Pennsylvania. There was like G.I. Joe karaoke and like everything. I mean, it was like just cartoon karaoke, but there was a person singing the G.I. Joe movie theme song, and it was amazing. You know, Sergeant Slaughter was there. Like, you know, it was just like this big nostalgia fest, which is big business, you know, across the country. And I'm just thinking about like how effective the advertising was at that time, that it's still reaping all of these benefits for all of these people that are, this is a whole huge, I mean, niche, but big market for this, absolutely, this type of stuff. I mean, and then you start thinking about it and you're looking at what's going on, what you see in mainstream media too. I mean, there's how many Transformers movies at this point. They're always looking for ways to reboot all these 80s properties, because there's such like a built-in intense like passion for these things, because and I was just like, there's got to be some story here at some point doing this. I was like, what's the story though, that like there was a million toys that came out in the 80s and like people still like them? And so that was like what I was thinking about for like a long time, and just like whatever. I was like buying Sears catalogs, and like a lot of those times when I'm like slow burning working on a graphic novel for like 10 years before I realize that's what I was doing, because like I just am doing something, and at some point I have these obsessions and stuff, and it, like at some point it comes together into something. And with the He-Man thing, I was just like, there's got to be, you know, then it all comes, then it's like He-Man and G.I. Joe and then Star Wars. And then, you know, looking at the behavior of like the fan base, Star Wars fan base, and like,
yeah, with the racism.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff, like crazy stuff, like anything that just goes against their understanding of what Star Wars is becomes like this like crazy controversy, and like people
heresy.
Heresy, right? There's people like, you know, all this stuff, and I'm like, what is this, you know? And it goes back to that Reagan deregulation thing, which was like that something that happened across the board at that time period. They were deregulating. I mean, that was Reagan's whole platform, really, is to deregulate. I mean, it was basically like the still the GOP platform for most things, is to just deregulate everything. So
except for trans lives, they definitely want to regulate. Right.
And they want to regulate the shit out of cannabis as well. Yeah. So, but like other stuff where they make a lot of money, they want to deregulate. And it all comes from this time period. You know, it's a lot about thinking about the Reagan administration and like, you know, because this started kind of before Reagan came to office. Like they had started moving this towards the end of the Carter administration, you know, and then when Reagan came in, it was like this opened up all the floodgates, right? And so I'm looking at, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, in a way, they really did just sort of red pill an entire generation with this passion that really borders on religious fanaticism.
Because it's like, it is like that, because it's something that is like placed inside of like a growing child, like a very impressionable child. And like they knew the power that they knew, like we knew, they knew all the things they did, because it's like they knew the power of what advertising does to children. Like we had the regulations in place in the 70s to protect children, because they know that children can't tell the difference between a TV show and a commercial. They can't tell that they're being advertised to, like,
yeah,
they, you know, it's just like this market that shouldn't be a market. It's just children's imaginations. I mean, and you know, we had the regulations in place to protect them, and we had recognized the detrimental nature of heavy advertising to young children. You know, when He-Man came out, I was 3. You know what I mean? Like, and I had all those toys. I was 3.
Same. I had all the toys as well. Yeah.
And all Star Wars and stuff, and G.I. Joe and Transformers. And it was a million other things that went by the wayside that are like secondary and tertiary toy properties. So we knew that was an issue, but we decided, you know, as a nation to not care.
Yeah.
And Reagan was like hired, you know, appointed a guy to run the FCC, who believed that the television should be regulated like a toaster, in the sense that they're just both electronics and that's all.
One of them can't burn your house down if it's not configured correctly. You know, as someone who grew up in this action figure toy boom of the 80s, and then also as a parent, and you, I think you're a parent as well, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. I have to admit that this book you wrote scared me.
Yeah. And,
you know, it sort of made
me too.
it made me wonder if these guys stole our imagination to sell toys and cheap cartoons. And what were you trying to scare me? That's what I want to know.
You know, I think that as I got into it, I was just like not shying away from what was going on for real. And I actually wrote most of this before I was an experienced parent. I was like, you know, a little, you know, my son was young when I had finished this. But I still now, you know, we have Disney Channel. My son, I have a almost 2-year-old son that watches like all the stuff.
Yeah.
Not all of it. I mean, some stuff I just that I feel that is just like blatant, this model where it's like advertising to kids, toys, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just like, no, we're not watching that. Some stuff, but there's also like, you know, stuff that's I feel is like very, very good stories and cartoons like for children, and they do sell the toys of it, but like for some reason to me it feels less salacious as like an advertising thing.
Do you have an example, you know, just so I can make sure I'm not destroying my kid?
No, I mean, my favorite show is Bluey, and they have a million toys for that. I mean, like
that, and that's a great example. And I think there's one thing Bluey does that cartoons in our generation didn't do. I felt like cartoons when we were growing up were always driven by sort of cheap, shallow conflict. These characters sort of locked in like a blood feud and just genocidal rage. Yeah. Wipe the other team
so much
out.
Of that, yes.
And where, you know, you watch Bluey with your kid and you're like, oh, wow, this is about emotional intelligence and caring about people. And we didn't have that growing up. Like, it was like,
yeah,
if someone disagrees with you, you have to wipe them out. It's not enough to just let them exist. You have to go into their base and destroy their base and try to destroy them. Like, they cannot be allowed to live. As I got older, it's like, wow, I kind of absorbed a lot of wrong lessons about how to
react. That is a good summation of a lot of the plots of the shows. It was like, you got a base, playset, good guys, bad guys, you know. That was like the concept of every show.
Well, you know, the Transformers, I mean, there were literally episodes of the Transformers where they just saw the Decepticons just harvesting food. They're like, we got to stop them. It's like, they really are just trying to eat right now. Like, maybe take a break this week, guys.
That's so funny. That's so true. They're just harvesting energon to live in this. They're also in this island, you know, deserted planet. In their way, you know, separated from their home.
Yeah, they're just trying so to live right now. Like, I get it. If they're coming after you, stop them. But it's like, now you really are just trying to wipe them out.
It is true though. Like the like, if you look at like Cobra Commander, like in terms of like creating a bad guy character, they created a person that was so messed up.
Yeah, like,
he was like. He would do such awful things for no reason, just like totally maniacal and like violent, and then like he's truly a monster, like completely
zero empathy.
Definitely. And there's, you know, I mean, there's still adventure shows and things like that now. I think they have toned things down a lot since then, but like the marketing stuff in some ways is worse now than it ever was. If you look at like the consolidation and the ways in which like Disney can exploit a property are so infinite and vast and growing at such an accelerated rate all the time. There's a show that came out, right? It reminded me of all of this is that came out this month called Star Wars Little
Visions
or something. No, it's literally looks like Cocomelon, and it's
oh
like,
yeah
and it's like the children that age, like for 2 and 3 year olds, and it's just, to me, that feels like so sinister to me now, because it's like you're getting these children in at such a young age and knowing that you're going to keep them until they die.
Yeah,
basically. I mean, like it feels like sinister to me.
So with that one, you, which my kid has seen several episodes and she likes, but with that one, you're like, no way, kid, you're not watching this.
No, because I'm just like, whatever. It's just like a thing. I think the most important thing as they're growing up and getting older is to like remind them about what advertising is, because it's at this point, I don't see any way we're going to pull back advertising. It's so prevalent and always growing, and it would be like, you know, almost impossible to kind of like pull it back. But, you know, you can educate your kid as you're growing up as to what things are. Like a seminal thing that I saw as a kid was a show called Buy Me That on HBO, which like explained a lot of advertising tricks and how
I remember that. Works. Yeah.
And I think that stuff like that is extremely helpful, not just for children. Adults need to understand like a lot of the concepts of advertising and the ways that corporations are pulling your strings, or else you're just beholden to them and just doing what they, you know, what they want you to do.
Well, you know, I think one interesting thing about being a parent in the streaming era is that my kid sees very few commercials. Mm-hmm. You know, I think all commercialization she absorbs now is in the content. You know, she'll see like a Star Wars cartoon and want Star Wars stuff, or she'll see a Little Mermaid cartoon and want to see this new Little Mermaid live action film. But there's less commercials. You know, when I was a kid, other than the cartoons which were directly selling toys, you know, one time I just watched a whole bunch of commercials from Nickelodeon, like just commercial blocks from Nickelodeon. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it really was sandwiched in a way where it was sugar, toy, sugar. And it was that phalanx.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, getting older now, like one of the things that I've been trying to do and that my doctor definitely wants me to do is eat less sugar.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just, they really did leave us to fend for ourselves.
Mm. I mean, they put there was a lot of people operating without considering the long-term, or maybe they did consider the long-term effects and just didn't care because the profit motive was so high. Or if I'm being generous, they just didn't realize. But I think that they probably did know that it was bad and just don't really care because it was so great to finally be able to do this business model that they wanted to do. Yeah. I mean, and it came down at the highest levels. I mean, if you look at who owned He-Man, it was a corporation that was like a fifth biggest it was the Westinghouse Corporation, which is a huge, huge corporation. And so, like, you know, they push, you know, deregulation like that doesn't just like happen because Reagan's like, I love deregulation myself. You know, this is my idea. No, it's like at the time, the Democrats had the funding of labor unions and that type. Those were the people that funded the Democratic Party. Companies, corporations, they were all on the right. And so like that before, this is like before Bill Clinton. So like in Reagan, if you can imagine, he had the power of every corporation on his side. So like everybody was in lockstep on how this was going to work.
And like, this is good.
Yeah. Like then Reagan, you know, the more I research about Reagan, he's like, that's the face of this like movement of deregulation, you know, and, you know, Reaganism, Reaganomics, basically, like, you know, this was planned. It was, like I said, they had gotten started before Reagan got to office. Reagan came to office and it was like, boom, blew the doors off the thing by 1982. You know, it was like the dates where He-Man started airing and when the actual law changed are so close together.
Yeah.
That it's like, they couldn't possibly have learned about the law change and then started working on He-Man. Like that didn't happen. Like they, in my opinion, started working on He-Man knowing that this was the next step down the road.
They were wiggling the tooth knowing they could pull it out.
Yes.
At that date. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the extraction date. Let's get ready.
It's like when, you know, Prohibition ended. They had cases of beer ready to go that day. So it's kind of like that.
Yeah, they were ready. Testament to American industry.
Yeah, they were ready to go.
Well, you know, a lot of these toy manufacturers were plastic companies. Like they made plastic. So like we can just mold them into parts that kids will buy at a 500, 600% markup.
Yeah. And they really are. Even now, this is another thing when I was reading about, you know, doing this research. And now when I get my kids' toys, I take it out of the box. I'm like, this is such a piece of crap. Like it's just this tiny, like molded plastic in such a certain way that you put stickers on. It's just like trash. Like, it's just like, I hate buying kids stuff like that. At the same time, when I was 5, I loved that piece of plastic. So, you know, it's crazy to me because it's trash really. And it's like floating in the sea. I think of like the Captain Planet toys all floating in the giant plastic, islands floating in the Pacific Ocean. Like,
yeah, the irony there, because they did make toys.
Yep.
With my kid, one of the things I've really tried to be mindful of, and this really went out the window during the pandemic, was how much time she spent on tablet and on devices, because I really think those things can just have a hypnotic power, you know. And And when we hit the pandemic and she was at home, she couldn't go to daycare or to school anymore. And I just had to watch her and then try to work a full-time job. You know, I really did have to just sort of shove the tablet in her
face. It's like help. It's because our world is so profit driven and messed up. We have to work all the time. It's so difficult to do both things, right?
Yeah.
Watch your kids. So these end up being like, all right, listen, I just got to make dinner. Look at my phone here. Here's my phone for a little while. And then you make dinner or you do whatever you're doing. And then you're like, oh, I'm going to look at my phone. All right, well, I guess I should stop. We should all stop looking at our phones now, because it's like an hour or whatever has gone by. And now your kid's like, bruh. And then they don't. You know, my son's almost two. He's so young. And like, he still is like, give me that phone. Just like, Cocoa Melon.
You know, I give, when we're at a restaurant and my kid's getting antsy waiting for the food, I will give her my phone and let her play a game. And someone was sort of commenting on that. It's like, wow, like, that's what parents do these days. And I thought about when I was a kid, my parents just hit us.
Yeah, so
it's like, I don't hit my kid. I do give her a phone, which, so maybe that's better.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's gotta be a step forward, Brian, right?
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. You would get yelled at a lot. We'd just be like, shut up, sit down. Yeah. I'm giving my parents, making it seem to be like demons, but you know, they'd be like, there was just like, you have no choice. Or the other thing, they would give us stuff. Like at a restaurant, there was crayons and stuff like that. This is, in a way, a better version of that. Also, I remember at restaurants, they'd have, like, I'd go out to, like, eat with my parents, and they'd have, like, two arcade games in the...
Galaga.
In the little area where you come in. And so, you know, when you finish dinner and you're antsy, they'd give you, like, $1.25 and say, go play. So it's not too different.
Getting some real Pizza Hut vibes right now.
Yes. Every restaurant was like that when I was, oh my God, you'd walk in anywhere, they'd have like not Street Fighter, but before that, like Pac-Man.
In the afterword you wrote as part of the book, you disclosed that you were a fan of some of these toys and cartoons. And I guess I was just curious, which of these did you like? And can you see examples of how they might've impacted you psychologically?
Oh yeah, I mean, like, well, first of all, like, I had all the G.I. Joe, Transformer, and He-Man. Like, those were like the three main ones.
Holy,
like,
Trinity. That was like,
yeah, exactly. But I also really liked Thundercats a lot. That was like one of my favorites. I watched like all of these shows. Like, I remember watching the Inhumanoids, which was like a show, a crazy toy. It was a crazy show. I remember watching it as a little kid and being scared to death, like as scared as like watching a horror movie. Like, it was so, like, the guys were just like, ugh. It was like,
they were like booger monsters, right?
Yeah, they were scary, man. They were scary, horrifying. They had cool toys, and they were, I remember getting those toys too. And there was also a lot of stuff back then that would be like a movie tie-in, like get like aliens toys and stuff. Like, it's an R-rated movie, like a Rambo toys. Like, these are like R-rated films.
You can play as a shell-shocked Vietnam War vet at home, kids.
I remember having the Rambo toys. I remember having the Dungeons and Dragons toys. Probably would get like one or two of like all of these franchises, and the ones that stuck around, you'd get like more than that.
Well, I remember listening to an interview with one of the creators of these shows, and he talked about how, you know, they made a show, Bucky O'Hare, and how it was really good, but they had to cancel it because they couldn't get the space on the toy shelves. That really determined what shows got canceled and what shows got renewed. Like, ad dollars be damned, you really had to sell toys.
Yeah, it's crazy how that would work. I mean, nobody at that time, even, you would never even consider putting out a cartoon without a toy.
Yeah,
you know, that would be like part of the whole reason. Like, there's people scoping out, like, with Voltron is kind of an interesting story, because it was like after the success of Transformers, and they were looking for the next big robot thing or whatever, GoBots, whatever, GoBots actually came out before Transformers, which is nuts.
People look at it as the knockoff, but it's actually the originator.
The original, they were looking for new stuff, and they found this Voltron and, like, changed the entire plot of the what it was about, and, like, cut a movie into a million episodes and all this stuff. And then just made these crazy awesome toys that went with it. And it was just like, that was the model. It was like, not really. It was like, if you can get those two things, right? A show that's cool with cool toys, like, you're rolling in dough, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long. It was like this short boom period. You know, it was like my whole childhood, but it seems like it, in the grand scheme of things, very short, right? Before things started to change. It was like 10 years. Or less, really.
You know, this was something I sort of chronicled in my documentary about Harry Knowles, and when they fired film critics and sort of left these fanboy movie critics to sort of take over movie culture, the products, the properties, we'll call them properties, that's a very shrewd term, that rose to the top were these things based on these toys we had as kids. It really was just our toy shelves, the movie.
It's crazy because it was the other way around. Like, that was how they figured this out in a weird way, because it was like they couldn't advertise to kids, right? And so they figured out to just make toys based on the people that were already media stars and were on TV a lot. That's why one of the biggest toys in the 70s was the Evel Knievel stunt cycle, because he was on TV all the time, right? Like, he was in media. And also then Star Wars comes out, and it's like these are just huge toy sales, because there's this amazing movie that's like the biggest thing ever, advertising to the kids all the time. And that's, I think, you know, when they were like, listen, the way to sell toys is to tie it to media. That's why we need these cartoons to sell the toys. Or else, you know, they can't do it. You know, it became like that was the method, was to that was the way, because that's what the toys were doing. They were trying to do it like after Star Wars. They were trying to make toys, but they couldn't like predict what movies were going to stick around for a year, like Star Wars, or a while, 4 months or whatever. And so they had to have they had to have their own properties.
You know, you talked about the toy shows and the people that packed these things out and spent thousands and thousands of dollars. You know, it to me, what's interesting about this culture, this is a culture I've spent a lot of time in, is that they almost exist as pharaohs, where their home becomes their tomb, and they surround themselves with all of these artifacts from their life.
Yes.
You know, and I say that as someone who's got a copy of their grandmother's copy of The Legend of Zelda hanging on the wall behind me. It's her copy. So I'm really
awesome.
Honoring, you know, her. She loved video games, and she had this one. So at the same time, it is a toy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does seem like an attempt to buy back our youth.
Oh, my God. I mean,
death.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good analogy, the pharaoh thing, because if you look at the people, so I've done a lot of this research, right, to you know, you can look at people that have like the most people all over TikTok and YouTube and whatever have like the craziest collections imaginable, like everything behind glass. You know, they make their basement look like a Toys R Us, like literally they have everything in packaging, and you know, and I understand that urge. I really do. It sounds silly, but I really do. In there's part of me that says, you know, if I ever like made millions of dollars and didn't have to work or anything, I might have a room dedicated to old toys and fill it up with all of my favorite old toys. And that's not like totally uncommon. Because if you look at, you know, like people of my dad's generation have cowboy stuff that they're like really love. And there are people that collect older toys from their own, you know, from way before the 70s down, you know, there's old toys for whatever that are collectible items. It's just natural a natural thing to like look over your life and remember all these things, you know. And I always have this negative perception about nostalgia because, you know, it's like the good old days were back then, but really those were not good old days. Like we've had so much reform and all this stuff. But I read a quote from someone, and I'm not going to remember their name, but it was in in John Porcellino's King Cat. This is a comic scene. He puts like a little note in it, and it had like a quote from someone talking about listening to music of their youth over and over again. And but it wasn't how we normally think of that, where it's like, oh, grow up, like, you know, start listening to new music, get with the times, man. He was like, you know, looking back on all this stuff for my life, and it brings new meaning. It brings back memories that I've forgotten about of that time. And it vibrates new each time you remember it. And it's true. I mean, it's not a bad thing to remember things that happened in your life. The thing I think about all the time, though, is that these wonderful memories that you're thinking back on are branded.
Yeah.
Your memories are branded with, you know, children's toys stuff there. You know, that if you think about what humanity is about, that place is reserved for that feeling for when you're a child. But maybe it should be like a sacred space and not something that you think back on and all you think about is Disney and you think about He-Man and you think about Star Wars. Maybe you should be thinking, I mean, I guess in a way, you know, you are in sometimes thinking about experiences that you've had as a kid and connections that you've made over Star Wars or over something like that. But part of me is like, get out of your Star Wars. Like, just remember the connection with the other person or the experience of free play or whatever it is.
I grew up in the woods, and that kind of did two things. You know, I played a lot in the dirt and with sticks, and I would always play this game with my brother called Stuntman, where we were always just falling off a hill in our backyard. And, you know, a lot of kids play today seem slightly safer, but also heavily, heavily branded.
Yeah, and I think the tablet thing and the constant access leads people to do more reenacting of things they've seen and less stuntman.
Yeah.
You know, games that they're making up on their own when they're, because when you're playing pretend like that, you're like making up, it's a great skill to learn and a essential part of human life to imagine things and to make things and make up and let your mind expand. When you're constantly reenacting to the letter, like the script that you've seen and done. I spoke to children's psychologists and things about this. It's not the same thing as imaginative play, which you know, psychologists agree is like important for child development.
It's like recitation or memorizing biblical passages.
Right. It's like, yes, exactly. It's a recitation rather than, you know, when you're pretending and playing with other kids, you're like negotiating, you know, you are divvying out responsibility, things like that. All that stuff's important. And, you know, maybe it's all doesn't matter and it's all working fine. And this stuff has no effect on any child's anybody, but it doesn't seem that way.
Yeah.
Because we're seeing the results in these in, you know, what the negative things that happen with fanatical. I wouldn't even call them fanatical because that would indicate that they were rare, but there's a ton of people like
that,
you know, see this stuff as gospel. And it's almost like a conservative and liberal approach to their own imagination.
And I had a moment, this was sort of a breaking moment for me in nerd culture, where I was at a comic book convention, Heroes Con in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's a great show. But I was there and I was buying something from one of the vendors, and then I saw where they had a display of decals for sale that they had made. These are all bootleg decals, and one of their bootleg decals was the Star Wars Rebel logo superimposed over the Southern Rebel flag. And I was like, whoa. Because it would never, it's like you watch Star Wars, you would never think those people were fighting for slavery, the heroes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's like, how could you make this equivalency? But I really realized, you know, white male nerds, especially, I think one of the draws, one of the pulls, one of the appeals to all this ephemera is that it brings them back to a time when they were on top.
I agree. I mean, there wasn't a challenge. That's the dangerous part of nostalgia, right? I mean, like, that's what we talk about when we're like, you know, we're nostalgic for this period. There's a separation, I think, in a way. It's like you're nostalgic for your childhood. Everybody is. I think that everybody in some ways wants to relive stuff. Even people that I've talked to that had like very traumatic childhood will tell me that like that it was all horrible except for I loved Popples, that I had my Popple, you know what I mean? Like, so same. Like that, it still like brings back a positive memory. But you're right, I mean, how far does this nostalgia go? And I talk about it in the book. If you like it so much back then, like this appeal to nostalgia is extremely powerful. I mean, this is Make America Great Again, right? I mean, like, that's an appeal to nostalgia.
Well, it goes hand in hand with fascism,
right? And that's the thing. It's like it's a feeling that you have, that feeling of your childhood, and you have this happy emotional memory. But that doesn't mean that it was perfect then.
Yeah,
it's just that you had a good, you personally had an emotional experience.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't indicate that everything was wonderful for any, you know, it's provably not.
Yeah.
If you look back, the farther you go back, like, just the worse it got. And that's when you start thinking about stuff, that's where it could go, though.
Yeah.
It could easily.
So I had an experience, you know, I did the thing you kind of vilified in your book. I took my kid to Disney World.
Sure.
And we went to the Star Wars land that they had there. And there's this new Star Wars ride. I'm going to spoil a little bit of it for people who've never been on the ride. But you get on the ride and essentially you are captured by the Empire, or the First Order, sort of the sanitized version.
Sure.
Corporatized version of the New Order, or the Empire. And they start unloading you from vehicles and getting you in lines to go to these interrogation rooms. And they're all dressed in these gray coats, and they're all yelling at you and shouting at you. They're flashing lights in your face, and we're all complying.
That's insane. It was
in this moment of compliance to these fake dictators, these fake genocidal fascist soldiers, that I realized, like, they've got us ready. Like, we're ready. All you've got to do is put a Marvel logo over the face of whatever it is, and they can wipe us out.
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree. I mean, it's a powerful, powerful thing that Disney and others are playing. You know, I like to be generous and say that these are unintended consequences. But maybe they didn't even consider those consequences.
Yeah.
I mean, and maybe they didn't know for real, because it hadn't been done at that level. They hadn't known that we're just going to sell stuff to kids or whatever. Kids buy toys all the time. Not realizing that they're actually, I mean, maybe they, you know, we could debate back and forth whether they realized it or not, but they were playing with fire.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely made me rethink at least going to Star Wars Land at Disney World.
I mean, there's also, you're telling me about this and I'm like, damn, I wish I was there.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's the thing. Like, that's why I've had to write the afterword, because I'm like, I can't, I'm not innocent here. I'm not, you know, militantly keeping my kids away from screens and never watching any children's programming or anything like that. Like, I'm just, this happened to me. Like, I was part of this experiment. You know, I was that generation. And yeah. So I'm just taking time to, like, look at what happened to me. Like, it's me processing my own life in a way.
So I want to shift gears here and talk about another book you wrote. This one being your 2016 book, Tetris, The Games People Play, a book I highly recommend. It's a graphic novel documentary about the battle for the video game rights of Tetris, the popular video game from Russia. And then this year, Apple TV Plus produced a narrative film simply titled Tetris with actor Taron Egerton, which makes no reference to your book, no mention of your book, but very obviously mines many of the same story beats and themes from your work. And I guess as a fellow documentarian, I couldn't help but wonder how you felt these weeks since it came out, having done the work to tell your story, only for it to kind of be copied by these other people.
You know, this is like a thing that happens if you're in doing nonfiction, right? Like, yeah. I don't own that story. Like, anybody can tell it. But this is not the first time this has happened to me, because after the Andre the Giant book came out, which was a New York Times bestseller, my best-selling book I ever made, they made an Andre the Giant documentary on HBO, which they talked to me about. You know, they said they were inspired by my book to make this film. Didn't reference my book at all, or didn't interview me, didn't talk to me, didn't mention that there was a book at all. Follows the same story plot line exactly, pretty much. And so this Tetris thing came out, and I was just like, oh well, I had known it was coming out for a long time, and I was just like, another situation like that, or the giant thing. I haven't watched it, and because, you know, I'm a little bit bitter because I want it to be based on my book or something. But also, I'm just like, I don't care. Watching the trailer was funny and fun to me, to be like, because it's so like, it seems like a very like, almost like they made it like an action movie kind of.
They did. And I actually want to ask you about that as probably one of the world's foremost Tetris scholars. Was the story of how they made Tetris violent? They made this look like a violent, tense thriller at times. Car chases, beatdowns.
There was... it's hard to say. I don't think that... on the Russian side, it's hard to say. Because, yeah. Like, we don't really know what happened. Like, they could have been speculating. It did seem pretty, like, a dire situation for the person doing the negotiating, because, you know, the higher ups were aware of Tetris because Robert Maxwell told Gorbachev about Tetris, and so there was a spotlight on this deal, and it was in a way like a huge deal for this new capitalist society to have a huge video game like that. And so on that side, yeah, Alexei, I don't know, it's more of like a sad story, but kind of just like, you know, this guy kind of tends to get screwed out of the money for this game that he created, more than it, I see it as like an action movie. There was a guy that helped create Tetris though that killed himself and killed his family.
They like omit that, him from the story that entirely.
That is extremely traumatic. When I learned about that, I was like, I have to put this in the book. How could you ignore this? It's so big. Yeah. And it also tells, I think, the overall theme of the book, right? You have two people from Russia Alexei and his friend that did this. He, you know, entering capitalist society, both working on this Tetris game and getting help coming to the U.S. and trying to make the American dream, right? And so one guy starts working for Microsoft, become, you know, gets this great job in Seattle, eventually gets the rights back to Tetris, etc. One guy's company goes bankrupt and he ends up becoming like a family annihilator, which is somebody that kills their self and their family. And, you know, it's hard to speculate why someone would do something like that, but it's a pathology.
Brutal.
And it's usually because it's usually a male doing it to the family because they feel that they can't provide for the family anymore, usually financially. There's other one. There's many, you know, this is from the research. This happens a lot. And, you know, it's like, look at these are the two outcomes of a capitalist society. You know, it's like you have this person, total success, this person, total devastation. So that's why I felt like I should keep it in there. And it also just like, it's crazy to me that they would not include that.
Well, the other thing that the movie does, which I think is interesting, is that it really concerns itself with this Taron Egerton character, one of the big deal makers who helped land the game rights for Nintendo.
He plays Hank Rogers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the creators of Tetris. Like, they kind of get short shrift in a movie about their game.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they probably got Hank's. It's probably Hank's life rights.
Yeah.
Probably. He played a central role in the thing for sure, in making it happen. And his friend, him and Alexei became great friends. That was the other part of the story that I thought was, I loved, is that those guys became friends. Yeah. You know, they became close friends. And so I don't know. I can't really comment too much about the movie because I never watched it. So
I don't know if I would recommend that you watch it. So you might be making the right.
I was hoping choice. That it would be a huge hit and everybody would have Tetris fever and start buying my book. But,
you know, it kind of brings me, you know, to sort of the next thing I want to talk with you about, which, you know, really is sort of the place that you played in both this story and the Andre the Giant story, is the person who really locked onto these narratives and did the most work and probably walked away with the least. And I don't know the situation, but probably of all the people involved in the Tetris movie, the least monetary benefit, you know, and this weekend there was a hashtag that broke out and you were sharing a lot of these posts. It's a hashtag that was launched in part by a friend of mine, and maybe you know her too, Kara McGee, which is hashtag comics broke me. And I was wondering if you could sort of tell listeners what this hashtag is about and why it was important to you.
Yeah, so it's about the nature of the comics business. We have a lot of stuff. We're seeing like the writer's strike going on and you know, we're talking about how there's a lot of talk all the time about unionization and the conditions of workers. And you know, I don't like to do this, but I often compare comic artists to pro wrestlers. We're independent contractors. We use our bodies to create this form of entertainment, and we often like get paid the least amount of money in the process. Like,
yeah,
almost certainly all of my editors my whole life have made way more money than me, like every editor I ever worked with, because they're on salary. They get a salary and they get health insurance and all that. And I'd been talking the last few years, even with my agent, about like, why couldn't a publisher pay for your health insurance?
Yeah.
Or when, and like, I'm also like, why can't they just hire us as an employee for a year and take our taxes out? And like, it's just so hard being a freelancer and there's so many things working against you all the time. And so like in every way, it's like, it's harder to get a loan. It's like, just so many, you know, the fact that you're paid here and there and everywhere, and it's never regular. You're on your own for everything, like, you know, all of this stuff. And you're often the one that they consider the most responsible for promoting your book.
Yeah.
You know, you have to promote every, you have to not only make the book, but be the face and character of the book. You know, all that stuff is, and it's up to you to do that. If you don't do that, you just miss out. I mean, like, and so like and it's difficult. And I, you know, if you look at like the Marvel page rate from 1972, it was like, the full page, if you did a full page, penciling, inking, lettering, everything, writing, which is what I do, you get paid $510 per page. Now, I've been paid $500 per page a handful of times, and that is where what I consider my rate. But like, not for somebody that's going to pay me, like if I'm just going to draw one page, maybe, but very rarely is somebody going to be like, oh, I'm going to have you draw this 230 page book and pay you $500 per page. Because you know what? That would actually probably cover the cost, because, you know, you'd be getting like $100,000+ instead of, you know, what you do get paid. And I mean, I'm not going to be honest. Like, I probably got paid pretty, probably on the high end for the last bunch of my books in terms of,
yeah,
you know, what indie creators can get paid. But I also completely maxed out that. And it's honestly, like, if I got paid a really good advance to make a big graphic novel, I would still 100% have to take on every freelance gig that came my way just to like make ends meet. Like, there's no way. Yeah, like there's just no way that it could be financed on what you're paid on the high end. Like, that's on the high end.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you sort of embodying best case scenario. But
right, like I feel so lucky. I feel bad complaining because I feel so lucky. Because I've been lucky with my career, but like also I'm still struggling. It's not like it's been a cakewalk, and it's not like it's easy. And you know what I mean? Like, and it gets harder and harder because it's been, you know, many years, and that high end number never changes.
Yeah.
Doesn't go up.
And you know, I think there's so many ways in which comics professionals are just completely discarded. Like, you know, when you watch these Guardians of the Galaxy movies, they're playing licensed music, which costs a lot of money to get in their movies. And yet the people who created the characters that these movies are based on are not getting any, usually aren't getting anywhere near that much money.
If they can help it, they're not getting any. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, is that we don't have any kind of union. We don't have a writer's guild. We don't have a comic artist guild. We have some upstarts starting up now, though. I mean, I think that this tragedy, it's really a cartoonist just like myself, younger than me, but a little bit younger than me, not that old, but just like myself, working, drawing as much as he could, and, you know, he's dead, you know, and
you're talking about the creator of Invader Zim, right?
Yeah, it's Ian McGinty.
Yeah.
It's awful. I mean, like, this is what happened in pro wrestling as well. Everybody started dying young. You know, and not only that, the people that are old cartoonists end up like old wrestlers that have, once you can't use these things anymore,
your hands, yeah.
Yeah. What are you going to do? I mean you're in the same position as like you know, a pro wrestler that has their knee blown out. They can't do their career anymore. You're done.
Because there is a physical toll for sure. You know, and that's why sometimes you go to comic shows and you'll see some of like the big pros, they're built like bodybuilders. But I think part of it is they're trying to do that just so they can keep using their hands every day.
Oh yeah, dude, you have to like really take care of yourself. Like, I will go through, if I don't sit properly on my chair, which I almost never do it, like I have to think about it all the time, I just get back pain. It just never goes away. If I sit improperly, I have back pain.
Yeah.
If I don't sit right, if I sit right, I don't. But, you know, and then as you get older, you know, it gets more worse, you know, all this stuff. It's like, there's no health insurance. You have to buy your own health insurance and you pay out, you know, pay a lot of money for it. And,
because it costs you more money to buy insurance than would cost a company, to buy
like a group of people. Yeah, a group rate. You get, it's just you buying your own insurance.
Yeah.
And it's like, I had to have an endoscopy last week, and it's $500. It's a 5-minute procedure.
Yeah.
Even with insurance, it's $500 plus $70 for the office visit or something like that. This is something that I had to do because I have a ulcer. Like, it's just like, and it's all leading up to the ulcer is like stress related.
Yeah.
And here you have to fix it. You have to do something stressful called pay a huge bill.
Yeah.
I mean, like it's a sad state of affairs across the board in our country, as far as that goes, but you know, being an independent contractor is not easy. And, you know, it's, if we don't protect ourselves, there's like no way for no time that the exploitation will end. It'll just keep getting more and more. They'll have just more taking more and more away.
So do you see sort of a remedy maybe starting to take form, take shape possibly with
I think that there's something awareness called the cartoonists co-op that is a group of cartoonists trying to do a lot of more collective action. I think that we have a lot of power as creators that we don't realize, obviously, because we're abused people and we don't recognize our strength. But, you know, none of these comic books that you see that are produced could exist without the creator. It couldn't. Yeah. It cannot. And it's a totally specialized skill. And it, you know, it's something that we deserve to get paid for.
I think so.
Yeah.
I get so much joy from reading your books, from reading comics in general. I really enjoy the form. And the thing that does sort of drive me wild is like, well, I guess if I want to help these guys, I can buy more books. But that doesn't help in a lot of cases.
You're right. Because you don't, some cases you're not even getting royalties. And so book sales don't mean anything or work for hire. It does in the sense that, you know, if the sales for the book are good, you might get another work for hire gig.
Yeah.
But like, these are all like the worst types of hiring of jobs, really. I mean, like the fact that no one is an employee at all. Like, I don't see how you can't, if you're hiring someone to do something that you want them to work on full time, why can't you just hire them as an employee?
Yeah.
Or take their taxes out and give them health insurance while they're working on the book. I'm not saying for the rest of their lives, but like, you know, something.
If you're doing like
something needs to be done.
If you're doing like a 3-year run on X-Men, then yeah, it makes sense. Like,
yes.
Healthcare, obviously. Like,
yes.
Because I don't know a single comic creator who's working less than full-time hours.
Yeah. No, I mean, you couldn't. I mean, I'm here constantly. It's a constant battle to try to get as much time as I can at work and still not neglect my duties as a parent.
Yeah.
And also to just like see my kids or hang out with them. And just for my own well-being, take time off from work. But like at the same time, I'm like, if I get sick, like, few times over the winter I got sick, I couldn't go to work for a few days. That's just like lost money. That lost money's gone. Money. Yeah. There's no paid sick days. Like you just lose the day, you lose the money, and it's just gone. So like you don't take days off. I had COVID one time when I came in and did a comic because I had to.
Just comics on COVID.
Yeah.
Wow. So I don't want to end on such a down note. So I guess let's try to find a way to pivot out here. What is one thing that is bringing you light, bringing you joy in this world right now?
Oh, lots of stuff. It's summer months are coming up. Yesterday took my kids to the, this is actually awesome. I love it. So there's a, in Philadelphia, there are, at every playground, they have sprinklers.
Yeah.
And they're cool. You know, kids can run through the sprinkler. We took them to this one downtown and like, it's great. There's tons of kids playing in it. And right across from it is a fountain, like an enormous city fountain that you're not supposed to swim in, but like every kid is swimming in it. And it's a million people swimming in it. And so I took my kids, my son to the sprinkler part. And he just looks over at that fountain. He's just like, points right at it. And he's like, we're going there. And like, so, but it was, and he got hurt like 2 seconds into it, but he rallied. And we had a really good time there. So I'm all for public playgrounds and public water fun.
Misusing kids. Public art.
Yes, it did say no swimming, like spray painted on the fountain, but they just don't enforce it. And really, how could you? You'd walk in and ruin like 40 kids' day completely. Like,
are you going to be the fun police?
Yeah.
Yeah, only for adults. But that's great. Well, that's good. We'll end it there. I want to thank you for talking with me. And I want to just let listeners know again that if you want to read any books by Brian Box Brown, and you should, because I think they're all great. Here are the ones to check out. I'm just going to read them all the titles. Okay. Is This Guy For Real? The Unbelievable Andy Kaufman, which is the third book I've read about Andy Kaufman, and for my money, the best. Andre the Giant, Life and Legend, which New York Times bestseller. Great story about a fellow North Carolinian, Andre the Giant. Cannabis, The Illegalization of Weed in America, which... you're going to read that one and really think, I'm a grown-ass man. Why can't I buy weed? This is bullshit. Your one nonfiction book, which I thought was really hilarious and sad at the same time, Child Star. Mm-hmm. And then Accidental Czar, The Life and Times of Vladimir Putin, which you created with writer Andrew Weiss. And the books we talked about today, Tetris, The Games People Play, and The He-Man Effect, the latter of which will be released on July 11th. And again, just all great books. Buy them from your local comic book store. If not, buy them on Amazon. Just buy them.
Just buy them, yeah. Just buy them. A review. Leaving reviews on Amazon is helpful.
Very helpful.
Believe it or not. Yeah, and I'm really excited about the He-Man book and was happy to talk about it today. So thank you for having me on.
Absolutely, man. And best of luck. And I hope that the situation with comic creators, if it doesn't get sorted out in my lifetime, maybe my kid's lifetime.
We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much and have a good one. I want to thank you for listening to that interview. And again, Brian Box Brown's book, The He-Man Effect, is coming out on July 11th. Purchase that online or preferably at a local bookstore or local comic book shop. It's a great read. Again, it's really hard to pick up one of his books and not just read the whole thing in one sitting. He's very good at what he does, and I hope you enjoy it. I think that's really it for Download. We'll be back at some point in the near or maybe distant future, but thank you, folks. Thank you again for listening to the show. And I'm going to go enjoy the beach now. Bye.
File's done. Goodbye.